All right, so let's start. We got a little bit left over from the nearest neighbor lecture last time. So we stopped when we were talking about the computational complexity and why nearest neighbor is slow. And so first of all, I thought I'd add a slide that just hammers home why exactly finding nearest neighbors is complicated. So and the difference has to do with the fact that the way we draw examples in this class sort of points in 2D, and the way that the algorithm sees the data is really two completely different things. You can get an intuition from one to the other, but you can't take it too far. So basically, if I told you to look at this picture and sort of tell me the nearest neighbors of a particular point, then it's very easy for you to do, right? You don't go in and sort of compare the distance from every point to this red point. What you do is you sort of immediately see, there's three points that seem to be somewhere nearby, and you see that immediately, right? So the problem algorithmically is it doesn't actually look quite like that. So what the algorithm sees as the training set, it sees a numeric representation, attributes and their values. So in this case, we have two attributes, x1 and x2, or x and y. So this is the set of points. It's just the set of coordinates. That's what the algorithm sees. And then the new point, a testing instance, comes in, and you want to find what are the nearest neighbors of that instance in this training set, right? And if you tried to do it just by looking at this without looking at the left-hand side, how do you do it, right? So it's a little more difficult when you see it numerically, right? On a picture, you see what the nearest neighbors are instantly, but if you look at the numbers, it's not quite as simple. So the way the algorithm works, if you want to get exact nearest neighbors for a certain point, what you have to do is you have to take this 7.4 and actually compute the distance to every single point in the training set. So what is the different distance from 7.4 to 1.9, 7.423, 7.441, and so on, right? And you can say, well, okay, maybe I should bracket, maybe I should play some tricks, not compare against all the points. A lot of those tricks work in low-dimensional data. So for example, for 2D and 3D, there are nice algorithms that help you find nearest neighbors quickly. 1D is a perfect example, right? So if these were one-dimensional numbers, how would you find nearest neighbors quickly? Just sort them, right? So you sort them, and then you can use binary search to get to the point very, very quickly. But these are 2D. You can't sort them. Or you can, but it's no matter how you sort them, it's going to lead to certain problems. You're going to miss nearest neighbors or get accidental matches. So in the general case, when you're doing it for high dimensions, you have to take the point and compare it to every single one of the other points. And that's n comparisons, and it takes d operations each, so it is slow. Now, there's a couple of things that you can do to make to make this comparison faster. So I said the basic complexity is for a single testing point, you have to do n comparisons, and each comparison takes d operations because you have d dimensions, d attributes, right? So two ways you can reduce that is you can either try to reduce d, which is complicated in and of itself, or you can try to reduce n. So reducing d, that means maybe I don't have to look at every attribute, every coordinate, every dimension. Reducing n, saying, this says, I really just want k nearest neighbors. So maybe if I do something quick and dirty to pick a smaller set of neighbors to compare to, maybe I can do better than that. So the basic idea is to identify a smaller set M and compare to that. And how you can identify the smaller set, there's a couple of different techniques depending on the data that you're dealing with. So if your data is numeric and low dimensional, there is something called KD trees, which we'll cover in the next slide. That's a way to organize the data spatially and find the nearest neighbors quicker. If your data is high dimensional, KD trees doesn't work. But there is, if your data is high-dimensional and sparse, there's something called inverted lists, which is a way of getting nearest neighbors very, very quickly. There's also another technique which I won't cover, which is locality-sensitive hashing. So that works for high dimensions. It doesn't matter if the data is sparse or dense. The problem is it's inexact. It leads to mistakes. In the same way that KD trees are an inexact technique, you'll see an example of where KD tree fails. Inverted index, that's an exact technique. You always get the nearest neighbors, and exactly the nearest neighbors. So let's look at KD trees, how this works at the data. So this is the same data set that we saw before. The basic idea of the KD trees, you're going to take the data set, you're going to build some sort of a spatial structure over it that breaks space into regions, and then when you have a new point, you're going to find out which region that new point falls into and just compare to instances in that region. Okay, so that's the big idea. Now, how does this work? The KD tree, it works by taking this data set, picking one attribute sort of at random. So I have two attributes, x and y, right? So let's deal with x's. So let's pick x. I'm going to pick x, and I'm going to find the median of the data set along that dimension, right? So the median is a point where half the points are to the left and half the points are to the right. So what does that mean here? So here, the median looks like it's going to be roughly around there. So half the points to the left and half the points to the right. So x equals 6 is the median of the x attribute, right? So now I've split my data into two sets. I'm going to have a set of points where x is smaller than 6 and a set where x is larger than 6. Now within each one of those sets, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the y value of the attribute, right? So for the set that is to the left, I have 5 points here. I'm going to find the median of the y values. And the median is this point. That's y equals 4. So I'm going to have 2 points that have a smaller value and 3 points that have a larger value of y. And then I'm going to do the same thing on the other branch of the tree. So here, these are all the points where x is bigger than 6. I'm going to find the median y value. That, of course, is y equals 8. So I have 3 points that are y is 8 or larger and 2 points where y is smaller, right? So this creates a partitioning of the space. And then you repeat this procedure for as many attributes as you have. Yeah?
Is the idea just want to make every region contains the same?
Yes, yes, yes. It's the same thing. So it's the same thing that you do with B-trees, right? So hopefully everybody has seen B-trees. Well, the cross on the boundary, the way you defined it is if the point is greater than or equal to the boundary, it falls into one set and not the other. So it doesn't fall into both. So the median falls into the right set. I've sort of arbitrarily said that y equals 8, x equals 6 falls into the right child of the tree and not into the left. It doesn't fall into both. Okay, but I am doing exactly that. I'm trying to construct a balanced tree. Only it's in two dimensions as opposed to one dimension for B-trees, right? So now once I've done that, I can stop at this point. I can keep going if I wanted to. So I could take this set and split it again on X if I wanted to. But if this has few enough data points, I can just stop at this point and say, okay, in this tree I have points 2, 3, 4, 1, so that's my region. That's one of my regions. This is another one of my regions, and so on, right? And now, of course, if I have a new point that I need to, for which I want to find nearest neighbors, the way I do that is I take this point and I sort of go down the tree. I say, for this point, this is 7, 4, is X bigger than 6 or smaller than 6? It's bigger than 6, so I'm in this branch. Now, is Y bigger than 8 or smaller than 8? Y is smaller than 8, so I'm in this branch. So this point 7.4, I only compare it to 7.2 and 9.6. And I could, or I don't even have to compare, I could say, well, these two are going to be my nearest neighbors because they fall into the same bucket in the KD tree in the same region of space. And you already see that this is going to make mistakes, right? So this is really the nearest neighbor, and you didn't get it. So that will happen no matter how you slice up the space. Now, there's probabilistic ways of slicing up the space that allow you to minimize the probability of that happening, but there's no deterministic algorithm that slices the space and guarantees that you will find the nearest neighbor. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. So this is what you do in low dimensions. About as good as you can do. If you're in a high dimensional space and the data is sparse, KD trees don't work. One intuition for seeing why they don't work is in a high D space, you have as many dimensions as you have the data points, right? So D is of the same scale as N and maybe larger. So if you're doing splitting on the coordinates, you're going to have as many operations in the splitting process as you would have in just comparing the point to every other neighbor. So it's not going to save you much. But there's something that you can do. So if you have high-dimensional data and the data is sparse, you can use inverted indices. This is a data structure that's used by search engines. And the basic assumption that it relies on is the sparseness. So it means that you have lots of attributes, but any given instance will have zeros for most of those attribute values. So what you do is, for every attribute, you store a list of items, a list of instances where that attribute occurs, where it's not zero. So it's very natural for binary attributes. So an idea there would be, if this is my data set, I have 6, say, emails, and maybe I'm doing spam detection. So what I want to do is I want to find, I'm going to get a new email, and I want to quickly find its nearest neighbors without comparing to everything. So the way you do this is first you construct an inverted index, which is a list of it's for every attribute. So the attributes in our case are words. Is the word present or absent? So the word send is present in every document, in every email except email 6. So you store a list 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The word account, it's a rare word, it's only present in email number 6, so I store just number 6 in there for account. And then what happens is, when I get a new email for which I want to find nearest neighbors, what I do is I look just at the inverted lists of the attributes that are present in that email. So that email has the word account, so I know that the word account occurs in training email number 6, has the word review. The word review occurs in training emails number 2 and 6. So what does that tell me? That tells me that the nearest neighbors for account review are going to be documents 2 and documents 6. And in fact, you can compute them directly from the structure rather quickly, and the complexity is much nicer than the linear comparison. Okay, all right, so that's it for nearest neighbors. The basic idea of the method is you're looking at distances. So instead of trying to learn something, you're saying, the way I'm going to classify new items is I'm going to look at the items I already have, find the closest ones, and just assign that class. We talked about you can use it for both classification and regression. It's a very simple technique, but very powerful. The main downside is it's quite slow for data sets, but we talked about two ways of dealing with that. And what you have to do when you're doing nearest neighbors, you have to pick the value of k, how many neighbors you're considering. You also have to give some thought to picking the right, so I don't say it here, but you have to pick the right distance function. Right? So Euclidean distance is not always the right function for K-NN. Okay. Yeah.
And then you, when you insert one new instance, you just calculate like the distance between that labels. And if you find the one which is nearest to one with a label like label A, then you then calculate the new one to.
Are you talking about the KD tree example? Okay, so this is not really a question you're asking. You're trying to come up with a way to do it better, and it's very good that you're trying to do that. It's an active area of research. The short answer is, it probably doesn't work, but that doesn't mean it's not worth exploring. So we should probably take it offline.
Probably just need to put it to sleep.
Oh, okay. So I don't know how macOS does it. I actually have to restart it.
No, but yeah, I'm not going to have to do that.
Okay, great. So that was K nearest neighbor. And so now, in the rest of the lecture, we're going to talk about a different kind of classifier, which are decision trees. So we're going to talk about I'll go through what a decision tree is, and we'll talk about how you learn decision trees from data. And we'll talk about different metrics for assessing whether a part of the decision tree is good or not. And those are going to be called entropy and information gain. And after that, we're going to talk about this issue of overfitting, which is, I don't think we've mentioned it before in this class, but it's one that comes up very naturally in decision trees, but it's actually a general issue that you have to think about whenever you're applying a learning algorithm. And then in the context of decision trees, there's this technique called pruning that you can use to help mitigate the effects of overfitting. And then we're going to talk about how another way to view decision trees is a set of rules. And you see, there's some reading from the assigned textbook. Okay, so this is an example of a decision tree. So this is based on a toy data set where the object is to classify given features of a particular day to classify whether it's a good day to play tennis. For me, it's never a good day because I don't know how to play tennis. But theoretically, this would be a good classifier. And so there are three attributes here, the outlook for the weather, the humidity, and the wind. So each one of those boxes is an attribute in the data set. And so you see outlook has three potential values, humidity and wind have two potential values. So the first thing you see is that you can think of each node of the tree as being a type of attribute. And then each of the edges, so there's an edge from outlook to humidity, and that's labeled with a particular value of the attribute. So that edge from outlook to humidity is labeled with a particular value sunny, which is a value of outlook. And so the edges of the tree are each associated with one of the class labels. So here, if I was given a particular day and I wanted to read off whether it was a good day to play tennis, I could say, oh, well, it looks like the weather report says it's rainy and there's strong wind, so I won't play tennis. So you just read down the tree like that. So that's what you would do for discrete inputs. You can also have decision trees for continuous inputs. So here's an example of a case in which I have actually two real valued features. And I want to decide based on, say there's a binary class label. So again, I have the top node of the tree is going to be associated with the attribute x1. And so then I can have a test on each of the leaves that says, well, x is x1 greater than the value theta1 or not? If it is, if it's greater, I'll go to the right. If it's less, I'll go to the left. And then I can do the same thing for x2 based on a different test value. So one thing to notice is that on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, I'm using a different threshold on x2. So this was the same as we saw in a KD tree. So on the left-hand side, I'll pick some value theta2 and say if it's less than or equal to theta2, I'll go down to the left-hand side of the tree. And if it's greater, I'll go to the right-hand side. Whereas up here, I guess I should have a pointer, but that's okay. I can just point at the screen. If it's up here, then on the right-hand side, I'm picking a different value, theta3, for the threshold. The other thing to see here is it's perfectly fine to use the same in the discrete case. It didn't really make much sense to use the same value twice, the same attribute value twice, because I've already considered all of the possibilities. Whereas in the continuous case, as you can see, it actually makes sense to use x1 twice, because I might want to subdivide the space more finely. And so for this tree, each of those leaves, I could again associate with the class label. So you see intuitively what you're doing is you're taking this two-dimensional space and you're partitioning it into rectangular regions. And on each one of those regions, you're going to make the same prediction. And so this is what a decision tree is. Each internal node tests an attribute. Each branch corresponds to a different value or a different region of the attribute. And then the leaf nodes make a prediction. So the way you can think about it is that you're partitioning the input space into a disjoint set of regions, and then using a very simple predictor for each region. So for the case of the classification, you could just say, given a training set, I'll look at all the training examples that go into that region, and I'll pick the most frequent class. That's typically the way you would use a decision tree to do classification. If I told you what the structure of the tree is, and I gave you a training set, and I said, well, how are you going to guess class labels based on the structure of the decision tree? Just filter all the instances down to the leaves of the tree and then see which one's most frequent in each leaf. If you wanted to estimate the probability of a given class and not just a single class label, you could look at what proportion of the instances go to the leaves. But so that's how you do classification with a decision tree. If you wanted to do regression, you can do that using a decision tree actually as well. You would just say that each of these regions, so A, B, C, D, and E, is going to have the same prediction according to the regression. So what I'll do is I'll look at all the training instances that end up in region A, and I'll take the mean of them on the output variable. And that will be my prediction for a new testing instance that happens to also reach instance A. So you can use decision trees both for classification, where I have a discrete output, and for regression, which is where I have a continuous output. Okay, so now we're going to talk about how to learn decision trees from data. So here's an example of a data set that we're going to use for decision trees. And it's in fact a data set that corresponds to the decision tree that we saw on the first slide. So each one of these rows is a training instance. Each one of the columns, except for the first column, each one of the columns is an attribute. And this last column here is the class label. So this thing at the bottom is saying a rainy, mild day with high humidity, strong wind, and not a good day to play tennis, which I guess makes sense. So, what do we want to, so this is a set of examples, and we want to build a decision tree that classifies this training set of examples. So, how are we going to do that? So, the first thing to recognize is that it's very easy to find a decision tree that classifies all of the training examples perfectly, so that gets 100% accuracy on the training data. So, how would you do that? Yeah, exactly. You just memorize all of the data, right? You just have one tree that has 1, 2, 3, 4 branches on each path, and then that's all the possibilities. So you just write down what's in the training set. So that's not a very interesting learning method, given that it's just a data structure for writing down everything that's in the training set. So it's not enough just to classify the training data perfectly. What you want to find is you want to find a reasonably small tree that classifies the data reasonably well. So what we're going to do is we're going to define basically a greedy algorithm for searching the space of trees. And the idea behind the algorithm is going to try to find the most important attributes first that do most of the work in classifying the training examples. And the hope is that by doing that, we'll at the end of the day, we'll have a smaller tree than we would have had if we just wrote down all of the attributes from all of the training examples. So here is a classic algorithm for inducing decision trees from data. It's called the ID3 algorithm. And the idea is it's basically greedy decision tree induction. So what you do at every point in time is, so this is going to be a recursive algorithm. So the main loop of the algorithm is what's on this slide. So we'll say I have some partial decision tree, and I'm trying to decide how do I want to extend it. So what I'll do is I'll go to one of the leaves of the tree, and I'll call that leaf, I don't have a name for that leaf, but I'll go to one of the leaves of the tree. So that's what this main loop is about. And then at each leaf, I'll look at all the attributes that I haven't, all the attributes that I could use. So there's some set of examples that have made it to that leaf. So for example, if I go back, so if I have this tree here, so there's some set of training examples that are both sunny and high humidity. So I'll go to this training set and I'll see, well, what are all the examples here where I see sunny high, which is, there's two of them up at the top and maybe it's just those two up at the top. So I'll take those two examples and I'll look at all the attributes that I could use to split those two examples up. So what I'll do is I'll go through all of the attributes and I'll look at which attribute splits up the training data best. And it's going to take a couple slides to define what best means. But for now, just trust I have some mathematical way of looking at a way that I could split these training examples into two sets in such a way to measure how good that is. So I'll find the way that's best. I'll find the way that looks best, the best way to split this node. And then I'll create, for each value of that attribute, I'll create a new descendant of the decision tree that I'll expand the decision tree with respect to that attribute. So I'll create a new leaf, I'll create new edges for each possible values of that attribute. And then I'll sort the training examples to the leaf nodes. And if I've now perfectly classified the training examples, then I can stop because I've done well enough on the training set. Otherwise, I'll iterate over the new leaf nodes I create, and I'll try to split them again so that I can perfectly classify the training set. Hopefully that algorithm kind of makes sense, except for the thing that I haven't told you yet about how you decide which attribute to use to split. The other thing I can point out now before I go into that is that this really is a greedy algorithm, right? At every point in time, I'm looking at the best attribute for this particular node. So that doesn't mean that at the end of the day, I have the smallest possible decision tree that classifies the data perfectly. I'm just kind of myopically one step at a time saying, for this leaf in the decision tree, what attribute would classify it best? So let's look at, I have a blank slide here. That's intentional. So what would it mean for an attribute to be a good attribute for splitting a decision tree? So let's take an example. Probably can't reach. I should put it a little higher than that. Okay. Oh, I can probably make this stop. How's that? Wow. Okay, good. So say I have some data set with two attributes. So this will be attribute one, attribute two, and then this is the class label. So if I have, so the first one I'm going to do, so I'll make these all be binary. So I'll have the first one say, let's say, so I'll make both the attributes and the class label be binary. So let's have five of them. Minus, plus. Okay, so let's see. So let me make this minus. And so I want x1 will be, let's see, does that work? So now if I make this one, two, okay. And maybe, yeah, that's okay, let me do it this way.
this is my, yeah, okay, I'll do it this way. Now, where is that? The first one? Yeah, okay. Okay, that'll do. Okay, so now, so say these are the examples that have reached some leaf, some node of the decision tree. And I want to say, well, now should I split them based on x1 or x2? So if I split based on x1 first, then I'll either be plus or minus. So now in this box, I'll look at the set of the examples in the decision tree that reached x1, that reached this new leaf. And so that's going to be this example, and this example. So here are the positive, so let's look at the positive classes. And the, so I'll write them like this. Here I'll write all of the example, no, I'm not going to do this. So what I'm going to do is for each example that reaches x1, I'll write down the class that reaches this leaf of the tree, I'll write down the class label. So that is this one, and this one. And then the other ones are negative, so that's this one and this one. And what I want to happen is, what I'd like is for these to be all the same class label, and if I can't get that, I'd like these to look as pure as possible. So I want as few exceptions like this as possible. Whereas if I split on x2 instead, I get something that looks like this. So I just have two, so I'm splitting on x2. So these two are positive for x2, and I get, so I get plus and minus. And these three I get all plus. So in this case, which attribute do you think I should split on? Doesn't really matter, right? Because it looks the same in each one. So if I change the class labels a little bit, so let's see. I flip, so I want minus to look. So let's say I should take, if I take this one, plus, minus, yeah. So now if I made this one a minus, is it still going to work better? So now this, right. So now I make this one a minus, then this x1 plus, one of these goes to a minus, and then this one of these goes to a minus. I'm not very good at this. Okay, so let's forget this part over here. And let's say I have something that looks like this. So now minus, minus, minus. Actually, let's do it this way. Plus, plus, minus, minus. And then plus, plus, minus. Okay, there are four over here, so then I get 3, 1. Okay, it looked like this, but they don't even add up to the same thing, do they? So if I did it this way, now which attribute would you pick? Now which one would you pick? X2, right? So what we want is a measure where things like this look good and things like this look bad. So one way you can think about this is that there's actually a formal way to think about this in terms of the amount of information that a random variable has. So if you think about it this way, if I tell you that an instance reached this node in the tree, that doesn't give you much information about the class label, because it's almost 50-50, 3 out of 5, which class label it's going to be. Whereas if I tell you that the tree went down, if I tell you that the node, that the training example got to this leaf in the tree, then that gives you a lot of information about the label, because everybody who got to this label is negative. So what we want is a way of defining the amount of information that this random variable gives about the class label. And so that's the kind of notion that we're going to talk about in the rest of the lecture. And so the measure we're going to use is called entropy. So entropy is this term actually from physics, and it means something like disorder, right? Because this is a much more disordered state of affairs with respect to the class label than this is. So entropy is going to be a measure of, how much uncertainty you have in a random variable. So if you take S be a set of training examples, and we're only going to look at their class labels. So we're going to say, given that sample S, there's a distribution over class labels. So, this P plus will be the proportion of positive examples, and P minus will be the proportion of negative examples. And so that gives you a distribution over this coin flip. And you want to say, how much uncertainty is there in that coin flip? So entropy is a way of measuring the impurity that there is in this distribution. And the way that it is by this formula here. So what this formula here is if you take the average, is you take the average value of the log probability.
So what does this mean?
Say I have a, so say I give you, I guess, do I even have an eraser? Probably. Yes. So say I give you a distribution that looks like this. Say I give you a fair coin. So I'll give you a coin where the, I guess I'll use P plus. But I could say just the probability of heads is 0.5, and the probability of tails is 0.5. Okay, so if I just look at the formula, the entropy of this distribution is going to be 1/2 log 1/2, and there are minuses in front of each, minus, so this will be, I'll call this H of P. So H is the letter that people usually use to denote entropy. So I'll get, and now the minus sign have gotten lost. Be minus 1/2 log 1/2, minus 1/2 log 1/2. And so if you simplify this, you'll just get log 2. That's right, log of 2. So that's so one way you can think about this, which I'm not really going to go into, but you will learn if you happen to be taking. We actually do have a class here in information theory, and you'll learn about this. It turns out you can actually interpret this as the average number of bits that you would need to represent a draw from this distribution. So it makes sense that you would need. So it makes sense that you would need one. So why did I get log? Yeah. Now this is right, log 2. Yeah, I did that right. So that's one value. Then. So let's look at another example. Suppose, so that's 1. So now let's look at an example that's very pure. So we'll say you have a really unfair coin that comes up almost always heads, and occasionally comes up tails. So now if I went through the same definition, what I'd get would be, I'll call this P2. So whatever's entropy of P2 is going to be minus 0.9 log 0.9. Minus 0.1 log 0.1. And it turns out that if you go to a calculator and actually compute what this is, it turns out this is a much smaller value than this. And in fact, the closer this gets to 1, 0, this thing, the entropy actually gets closer and closer to 0. So I think I'm not going to bother plugging that in right now. But it's a small value, because the thing is, this thing here is getting closer and closer to log 1, which is 0. And this thing here is also getting closer, because this thing is getting closer and closer to 0. So what's happening is this thing is going to be a very small number.
So that's an example of what entropy is. So entropy gives us a measure that says distributions that are very impure are going to have higher entropy.
And distributions that are very, distributions that are very pure are going to have higher entropy, and distributions that are very pure are going to have lower entropy.
The minus signs always confuse me. I have to be careful to say the right thing. Okay, so now I can say, if I'm going to split a node, now I'm trying to figure out whether to split a node in the decision tree. So when I say, if I want to split a node, how much more pure am I going to make it if I sort on a particular attribute? So that's called the information gain. So what this is it's essentially the difference in entropy between the examples that just reached the node I'm trying to split and the expected entropy that I would have if I were going to split the nodes on A. So you can actually think of this as a measure of how much information that attribute A gives about the class label. So, for example, in the So example, so these are a set of numbers from the play tennis example that was on the previous slide. So there, in that case, there are 14 examples in the whole data set. So we'll just say suppose we want to decide which one's going to be the root node, right? So there are 14 examples in the whole data set. So that gives you a split of 9 and 5. So you can think of that, you think of those as probabilities, there's like 9 over 14 and 5 over 14. So that gives you one set entropy there that you could compute just like this. Now then, so that's the entropy if I didn't make a split at all. That's this entropy of 9, 5. Now suppose I did decide to split on the attribute outlook. So so each one of these three terms on the right corresponds to one possible value of the outlook variable. So this should be sunny, sunny, overcast, and rainy in order. So if I have some new training example, well, probably 5 out of 14th of the time it's going to be sunny, because that's the value in the training set. And if it gets to that leaf, then there's a two-fifths chance it'll be in one class label, a three-fifths chance it'll be in the other one. So we'll take the entropy of the distribution two-fifths, three-fifths. And then you can do the same thing for the other two leaves. So that gives you a measure of on average, if I split on this attribute, if I split on the attribute outlook, where would I, which leaf would I, on average, of all the leaves that I would end up in splitting on that attribute, what's the value of this purity score? So it's like, what's the average value of the security score weighted by my chances of which leaf I'm likely to end up in? So what this gives us is a difference of this kind of entropy measure of purity if I didn't split, and the average value of the entropy if I did split on that attribute. And so I want this, this is something that I want to be large. So in this case, I get 0.25, I get about 0.25 bits. And the reason that I'm subtracting here is entropy is a measure of, the reason that I'm subtracting is I want there to be less entropy after I split than there was before I split. Right, so that's why I think the old entropy minus the new entropy, and I want that to be big.
So that means that it's more pure after the split than before the split. That's for an example of, so that's basically how decision tree learning works. So what I do is I'm just recursively going through the tree. At every point, I have some mini decision tree with examples that have reached each of the leaves. And for each leaf, I look through and I say I'm going to find a way to split the attribute that locally maximizes this measure of information gain. And then once I've perfectly classified the examples, I stop. So are there any questions about how decision tree induction works? Okay. Okay. So now I want to talk about this issue of overfitting. So overfitting is this issue that especially affects decision trees, but it can affect any classifier whatsoever. So the issue with overfitting is if I have a small training set, then you don't want to memorize the training set. And the reason is there might be things that just accidentally happen to be true in this small training set that aren't still going to be true if I move to a larger population. So if this class actually is a fairly large number of people. But like if I took the people like in the front row here, it could all happen that they were born. That's a small training set of people. It could all happen that they were born in January. But that doesn't mean if I went to the whole course that everyone would be born in January. So that's a generalization that I shouldn't make. So one thing that happens with... So what can happen with a small training set is, the bigger the tree, the more likely it is to over. So overfitting means that I found some classifier in general that works really well on the training data, but doesn't work nearly as well when I give it a new train, when I ask it to classify new points that weren't in the training data. And the reason is that it's trying to memorize these accidental features about the training data. So with decision trees, as we saw, larger trees tend to be more overfit. And the reason is because larger trees can remember more about the training examples, right? If we had a large enough tree, we could memorize all of them. We can memorize all of the attributes in the training data.
So what I have from this graph here is an example of training decision trees on a real data set. So the x-axis here is the size of the tree. It's the number of nodes in the tree.
So what happened is they built a full tree, and then they kind of incrementally lopped off leaves of it in order to make it smaller and smaller. So zero is if you didn't split at all, and then these things are really, really big trees. And so the y-axis is, well, what's the accuracy? So you can look at the accuracy of the training set, and obviously it has to be the case that as I increase the size of the tree, I can't hurt the accuracy of the training set by doing that. So the accuracy goes up. And for a while, and then also we look at the accuracy of a new set of testing data that doesn't overlap with the data that we used for training. And what happens here is it goes up for a while, because I'm learning real things about the data set. And then after that, it starts to go down again. And that's what you see, and that's what overfitting is. And this happens for a lot of classifiers. It can be especially bad for decision trees, because they allow you a lot of flexibility. But this can happen for any kind of classifier. So whatever you see is a set of, so these are called learning curves, right? So whenever you see learning curves that look like this, then that means you probably have some kind of overfitting.
So if you were running on a data set and you saw something like this, I mean, what's the obvious thing to do? Yeah, make your tree smaller. If I have a big tree and it overfits, well, then I want to prune the tree. I could also get more training data. That would be another way to go. And if you can afford to do that, it's always good to have more training data. But given a fixed size of training data, yeah, try to make the tree smaller. So that's what people call pruning. So the idea is, rather than trying to get every single training example right, I'll allow the decision tree to get allow some of the leaves not to be fully split, in the hope of getting a smaller tree that still explains the data reasonably well. So this is especially important if you feel like there might be noise in your attributes or in your class labels, because if there is, then the decision tree is going to try to memorize all of the noise, even though it shouldn't. So there are a couple different ways of doing that, and they're discussed in the book. The most common way is to grow the tree all the way to the bottom, and then lop off things from the ends. So that's called post-pruning, and that's described in chapter 6 of the book. And so the easiest way to do that is to use what's called a validation set. So this is a separate set of data. It's separate from the one that you used to build the tree, and it's also separate from the one that, you know, if you're reporting accuracy to your boss or something at the end of the day, it's separate from that set too. So it's just some set you use to tune the parameters of decision tree induction. And so what you would do is you'd make some curves, is you'd build a tree all the way out, and then for each leaf node of the tree, you look at, take the tree with that, go to the end of the tree, lop off something at the bottom, and then now you can look at it, how well does it do on this independent validation set, both before I lopped it off and after I lopped it off. And as we've seen, lots of times lopping it off will lead you to better accuracy. And if it does, then go with that tree instead. That's probably the easiest way to do it. And if you have enough data to do that, that's probably what I'd recommend. There are some things you can do, kind of hacky methods that you can do. If you have a very small amount of data, you might not want to split it into a training set and a validation set. And the reason for that is that why would you want to make your training data for building the tree be even smaller? And if that's the case, then there are some things that are talked about in the book of how I can kind of hacky heuristic ways for deciding when to prune things off given only the training set. So you could do that. So that's another kind of thing that you can do. But I mean, this thing that's on the slide is the simplest method. Okay, so just to it's 2:50. Okay, so let me just summarize what I've said so far. So we've talked about, so we have this framework for thinking about all kinds of learning.